here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, September 9th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Jeremy Saulnier's new movie, Rebel Ridge, and we will present an interview with writer, director, editor Jeremy Saulnier. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris, let's talk a little bit about this movie. Let's do some general thoughts before we get into spoilers. So broadly speaking, what did you make of Rebel Ridge?
I really like this. You can read my review at slashfilm.com for even more detailed thoughts, but I'm a big Jeremy, although I realize that I'm pronouncing his name wrong. How do you say it?
It's Saulnier. I always thought it was Saulnier, but
so did I. Yeah,
yeah, that's Saulnier is how I heard it pronounced.
All right, so Jeremy Saulnier, I'm a huge fan of his work. Blue Ruin, which is his second feature, is incredible. Green Room is great. So I was really looking forward to this, and this really delivers. I have some issues with it, which we'll get into, but the first hour alone is so like meticulously crafted. I'm a big fan of watching movies where people like engage in a series of like well thought out tasks. Like,
yeah,
like the first hour of this is really the main character. His name is Terry, played by Aaron Pierre, like slowly going through the motions of like trying to do the right thing. And everything he does doesn't work for him because he's butting up against like, you know, corrupt, hard headed cops. And there's just something really rewarding about watching this guy like act. I really think a big part of that is Aaron Pierre's performance, which is really, really good. We can talk about that too.
Yeah, absolutely. He is tremendous in this movie. And people may or may not know that John Boyega was originally cast in that role and he had to leave the production. And so I thought as I was going into this that I was going to be watching two movies in my head at the same time. I was going to be watching the fictional John Boyega version alongside the real version that we got. But I think a testament to Aaron Pierre's performance is that I didn't even think about that a single time because he's just so compelling as an actor that I just like put that out of my mind entirely and was just really mesmerized by what he was doing. So
yeah, I say this in my review, but you know, as much as I like John Boyega, John Boyega is a really great actor. I'm actually kind of glad it worked out this way because I had like, I can't imagine the movie without Aaron Pierre because his performance is so good. He's doing this like very internalized, intense performance. I think a part of that is he has really striking eyes. He has like beautiful eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think Saulnier really realized that. So there's a lot of close-ups of like his face as he's like working things out in his head. And you're like just drawn to him because he just has these really like piercing eyes. And you're just like, oh my God, this guy is, he's like a movie star in the making. Like I know we don't really have movie stars in the old-fashioned sense anymore. I say this in my review too, but this movie like deserves to make Aaron Pierre a movie star. Like his like feature debut, I didn't know this, but I didn't know this was his feature debut, but I knew it when I wrote the review. I looked this up, was playing mid-sized sedan in M. Night Shyamalan's Old. So I and he was also on the Underground Railroad, which I sadly have not watched yet, but I really hope this like really like makes his career take off because he's so good in this.
Yeah, I think Underground Railroad is where I saw him first. And I agree that everything sort of shook out the way that it was supposed to, because even if John Boyega is not in this movie, like the Star Wars movies gave him such a career boost and such a profile boost that like everybody knows who John Boyega is at this point. He's pretty much a household name, even though he's had kind of an interesting post Star Wars career. Maybe we'll talk about that on another episode of the show or something. I'd really love to see him. I like him a lot as an actor. I would love to see him in something great again, but because it's kind of been a little while. But yeah, this is kind of the perfect, hopefully, I mean, as long as this doesn't get buried in the Netflix algorithm, this is theoretically the type of perfect launch pad role for somebody like Aaron Pierre to step in and really get that bump that I hope he gets out of this. So it's just excellent. I think this movie is really infuriating to me in the best way, like in a way that pulls you in and sort of drops you into the experience of the main character, where you feel like the world is against you when all you're trying to do is just accomplish this really simple task without bothering anyone. And that's such a relatable feeling where, like, I mean, obviously the scenario here is a little bit heightened, but that core feeling, I feel like everyone on Earth has experienced that in, to some degree or another. So this movie does a really good job of tapping into that. And like these crooked cops, man, these characters, they can't leave it alone. And ultimately they just realize that they've bullied and beaten and sort of taken advantage of the wrong guy here. And I love, what happens after that. So you mentioned Blue Ruin. I actually watched that movie this morning for the first time. I had seen Green Room, but I was mostly unfamiliar with Sonia's other work as a director. I've had Hold the Dark, his Netflix movie from 2018, in my queue since 2018. And I just haven't gotten around to seeing it yet, but I really liked Green Room a lot. And I went back because I remembered that Blue Ruin was really like the movie that sort of put him on the map in a big way. What do you remember about that movie and why do you like it so much, Chris?
His feature debut is called Murder Party, which I eventually saw, and that's okay. But like, I didn't love it, but like it felt like Blue Ruin came out of like nowhere. Like I had never heard of this guy, and I watched it. I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it when it came to Blu-ray, and I was like, "Holy shit! This is like it's so well crafted, and it's such like a stripped down, like simple movie. It reminded me a lot of the more serious work of the Coen brothers. I know the Coen brothers make a lot of silly movies, but when they get serious, like this felt like that, where it's about like a series of events that lead to like problems and mistakes. And I just love the way it plays out. Like, and it's true of this movie too. Jeremy Saulnier makes movies about really men engaging in violence. And it's about violence leading to more violence. And like Green Room is that, and this movie, Blue Ruin in particular, is that, where it's about this guy like setting out on this sort of like revenge quest and just making more problems for himself and everyone else as a result. And it's so well crafted, and it's so the performances are great. Macon Blair is really good in this, playing this sort of like, you know, drifter guy just making one mistake after another.
Yeah.
And just the way it ends, I don't want to give it away, people haven't seen it, but it knocked me on my ass. I was just like, man, what a like brutal, like unexpected ending. And I love Blue Ruin. Blue Ruin is actually my favorite of his movies.
Yeah, it's very good. It's a pretty small scale movie. Like it feels kind of like an indie movie, you know, there's not like major actors in it or whatever, but like it is extremely effective. And just really Macon Blair especially, I think, carries the movie in a big way. He's got such a haunted nature to that particular performance that is super effective in that movie. So I would recommend people check that one out if they watch Rebel Ridge and enjoy that work, because it does, like you said, it had that same sort of meticulousness to it, where he's just you follow this. He does a really good job as a director of dropping you into scenarios where you're following a character just going through the process of like step by step. It reminds me of Ripley that we talked about earlier this year, where like the Netflix series that Steven Zaillian did, where the camera is really just kind of with that character for most of the time. And you are in their headspace and watching these characters make decisions and like go about their business and try to cover things up. And they're most of the time they're pretty bad at it. So that's kind of entertaining. And it kind of puts you in that position of like, what would I do in this scenario? And how would I react differently than this character and all that? So anyway, good stuff there. Okay. So let's talk about some spoilery stuff about Rebel Ridge here. So if you've not seen the movie yet, this is your final chance, final warning. So to me, like part of what this movie is about, Chris, is how systems of power can be buried in this absolute nightmare of bureaucratic red tape. And then that red tape acts as a barrier and almost like an impenetrable wall or something for anyone on the inside who decides to abuse the system to their own advantage. And I'm pretty sure that Jeremy Saulnier said that he started writing this in 2018 And considering what was going on in our political landscape at that time, it's not really surprising to me that those ideas would be something that he would be interested in exploring. But he does so in this really interesting way, wrapped up in this genre story. And yeah, it gets back to that infuriating quality of the movie where like he tries to do the right thing so many times, and he even goes so far, Terry, I'm talking about the main character of this movie. He even goes as far as to say like, hey, Don Johnson, the corrupt leader of this police force, I will give you like tens of thousands of dollars in cash that I have just to let me save my cousin, and I'll walk away from this whole scenario. And these friggin' cops, they just can't do it. So I don't know. I was very taken by like the, it's not exactly subtle, but the larger points that he might be getting to in this story. And I just thought it was like a really, really effective thriller. So yeah, what kind of spoilery stuff do you want to talk about here?
Yeah, so my biggest, I don't even say it's an issue because I don't think it's a problem, but my biggest surprise with the movie is how unlethal it is. I feel like, especially based on Jeremy Saulnier's work in general, we've come to expect a sort of like almost cathartic level of violence from action movies, you know, like the John Wick films, or this film in particular feels, you know, like a lot like Reacher, the TV series Reacher, and even like Rambo for the First Blood movie, the original Rambo. And we've come to expect like a body count from movies like that. And the entire movie, I kept waiting, like, because I've seen so many movies and I know how movies work, I was like, all right, sooner or later, I know where this is going. I know this is going to end with this guy, with the character of Terry, like killing these cops. And that would be great because, you know, Saulnier doesn't like paint them as overtly racist, but you know, you can read between the lines. Like, this is a black man going up against a group of good old boy Southern cops. Like, mm-hmm. It's there. It's very much there. And you're like, all right, there's going to be this cathartic sort of finale where he just straight up murders these guys. And Terry never kills anyone in the movie. Even the Don Johnson character, you know, who's, you know, the head villain, for lack of a better term, doesn't get killed. And I was really like surprised by that, because I was like, you know, like I said, like, that's what you expect from a movie like this. You expect him to at least kill one person, and he never kills anyone. You know, there's this big climactic fight scene, and earlier in the movie Saulnier sets up the fact that the cops have all these non-lethal weapons, and Terry deliberately starts using all these non-lethal, you know, like guns that shoot beanbags and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, that's so different than what we've come to expect from an action movie. He's deliberately subverting our expectations here. We're expecting him to kill these guys, and he never does it. He just, you know, he incapacitates them. It's rewarding to watch him beat the crap out of these people. But I was so surprised with that. I was also really interested in how the action is portrayed, because especially in this day and age where, you know, like David Leitch and filmmakers like that have made these action movies that are very highly choreographed, the action in this movie is very like clumsy. And I don't mean that, I'm not saying that like that's a bad thing. Like, I think it's deliberate. Like, the very first scene where Terry like fights someone, it's really like rough and ugly, and they're like rolling around on the ground basically. And I was mm-hmm. like, oh, this is so, again, this is so not what we expect from, like, we expect, like, you know, John Wick basically, where it's like every hit is choreographed. And this feels more like, I guess, for lack of a better word, realistic. It's like, you know, when you, if you've ever seen like people fight in real life, it doesn't look like a movie. It's ugly, and people are just like slapping each other basically and rolling around and like making a mess. And that's kind of how the action scenes are in this movie. They're very like raw and unrehearsed. And mm-hmm. I was just like, man, that's so different than what we've really come to expect. So I'm genuinely interested to see how this goes over with the movie going public, or the movie watching public, because you're not going to go anywhere to see this. Because like I said, like we've come to expect a certain amount of violence from these movies, and Saulnier is deliberately denying us that. And I wonder if people are going to feel like cheated or something like that. Like I said, I don't think it's a flaw. I think, obviously, it's very intentional, and I kind of like that the movie is doing that, but I'm genuinely wondering if people are going to be like, why didn't he kill all these people?
Yeah. Yeah. So I, you and I spoke a little bit before we started recording and before I interviewed Jeremy Sonia, and I actually asked him about this so people can hear him address this topic directly in the interview coming up in a little bit. When I was watching it, my experience was just thinking back to what you just said a couple minutes ago of like, this is a black man facing off against this almost entirely white police department. And I just thought this character probably would think that that is a line too far for him to cross, to just like go on a murder spree. Like I just thought that maybe he purposefully chose the non-lethal route because if he killed any of these guys, really, his entire life might be over. He would have to spend the rest of his life looking over his shoulder or something. And so that was like the one thought that I had watching that to sort of justify that question that was raised in your mind. I don't know if anybody else will have that thought, but that is just what went through my mind. The one thing I did want to ask you before we get into the interview itself is about the ending of the movie. And I think we've talked about this briefly before too, but I think the movie kind of fumbles the ball at the very end because it ends with several of the same police officers who were just engaged in this big shootout with Terry suddenly changing their allegiance and supporting him at the end of the movie. So that ending implies that Don Johnson's character, the leader of these cops, is like the one bad apple, and the rest of these guys were basically just kind of fine, upstanding citizens who were just following orders. And I don't know, I kind of feel like if that's the turn that Sonia was going for, he needed to do a better job of seeding that idea throughout the movie, because as it is, it feels really abrupt. It feels like the movie is going out of its way to make excuses for these characters or something. And the whole thing feels pretty rushed and sudden and kind of unbelievable in a movie that otherwise takes pretty great care to have every step feel really believable. So I was wondering what your take was on that.
Yeah, I don't think it ruins the movie, but I do agree that the ending, where like there's a moment where they're like I buy that there's, you know, that one female cop, I can buy that she will like change her mind. Like I buy that. But the fact that it's all the cops except Don Johnson, and there's, I forget his name, but there's like another cop who's really like gung ho at being an asshole. But they're like, they give Terry like a police escort to the hospital. And it's like, I don't know if we need it. Like, I feel like you could have ended it with Terry and the Anna Sophia Robb character, and they get away and they just go to the hospital on their own, and the cops can just give up. I feel like you could have done that. It's the whole like the cops will give them a police escort that like just does not quite really like, why are they suddenly like okay with this guy? Like I could buy them like wanting to save their own asses and like, all right, our corrupt boss got caught, let's turn back so we don't get caught too. But it's the fact that they go along with the character that just doesn't quite ring true.
Yeah, it's just a 180 to the larger messages that the whole movie has seemed to be presenting through the whole time about the corruption and the sort of small town nature of these cops and like how they have found their way basically inside this castle and they're doing whatever they can to build up their power within it. And you see these guys, it's not like Don Johnson is the only douchebag on this squad. Like David Denman, who is what's his name from The Office, Pam's
is it Roy?
Roy, yes. Yeah. Roy from The Office. He's the one who initiates this entire scenario with Terry. I think he is the one who is driving the car when he like bumps Terry on the bike from behind and just goes into this whole thing. And then it's revealed later in the movie as a sort of like bait and switch that David Denman's character is actually the, I think they call him Serpico, like the sort of the one good cop on the inside is how it's sort of portrayed in the movie, which like, I don't know. I guess that kind of works as a twist or something, as a revelation. It's a little weird, but I can kind of buy that. But then, yeah, you've got like Emery Cohen, who I think is probably the actor that you're talking about, who plays the other cop who's like a real dick. He's the one who like throws the gun inside of the vehicle when Terry is pulled over and like starts trying to shoot at him. And like you can tell that he is like rotten to the core as a human being. But this movie doesn't give you that catharsis that you're looking for, at least not in the traditional way. And yeah, it's just a really interesting choice on that front. So yeah, overall, I really, really love the movie. I feel like it went from like a 10 out of 10 to like an 8 out of 10 in the last 2 minutes or something like that for me personally. But yeah, I just wanted to talk through some of my feelings about the ending. But is there anything else that you wanted to mention about this film or any other aspect of it that we haven't discussed yet?
Don Johnson, really good at playing assholes, man. Mm-hmm. I feel like he can play, like he's pretty much just playing the character he played in Knives Out again, but he can just do that character in sleep, but he's really good. And yeah, I just, like I said, I just really hope this launches Aaron Pierre's career. It's really kind of a bummer that this is like a straight to Netflix thing. You know, on one level, I'm glad Netflix financed it and they're releasing it, but you know, if this had come out like 10, 20 years ago, it would go to theaters and it could be like a sleeper hit. And it's like, we just don't get movies like that anymore. Those movies are like destined to go right to streaming right now. And I'm really worried this is going to like cause some buzz over the weekend and then everyone's going to forget about it because that's just what happens. I really hope it doesn't. I really hope like, you know, this gets a lot of attention because it deserves it, you know. Problems with the ending aside, everything else is so well done. And I just want Jeremy Saulnier to make more movies. So I really hope this gets attention.
Yes, well said. All right, well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be back with my interview with Jeremy Saulnier.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeBest Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, my pleasure.
So you originally had John Boyega cast as your lead, and he had to leave the project several weeks into filming due to family reasons. And you found a phenomenal replacement in Aaron Pierre. I'm sure you have great things to say about him. I would love to know, though, what that period of uncertainty was like for you, because having to recast your lead actor that deep into a production is an unusual challenge for a director.
Absolutely. I mean, we certainly faced headwinds on that version of the movie, but honestly, it just ended up for the better. And luckily, I actually cast Aaron within weeks. So we conspired, got on a Zoom together, and fell in love. You know, he loved the project and was willing to take that leap with me. I got on the Zoom with him and knew within 2 minutes that, oh shit, this is the guy. This is our guy. And you know, out of respect to all involved, like I won't get into the whole departure, but it was necessary. And actually there was no ill will. It was just like, oof, you know, after the COVID shutdown, we had to shut down again. But it truly was the only version of this film I could ever realize. I saw Aaron on that Zoom and then a year later saw him on set and knew that I had struck fucking gold.
Yeah, he was awesome in the movie. I was wondering if there were any tweaks that you made to the script once you started working with Aaron and saw his strengths as an actor and sort of what he was bringing to the character.
No, and that's a testament to Aaron. It's like the character was always the character. And because it did get protracted over a 3-year period, I had to give myself space and I did not go and tweak and tinker. I trust my gut as a filmmaker and wanted to sort of, when I lit that fuse in 2018, started writing it, I wanted to just let that explode as it would have. And to make that happen, I had to sneak away and start another script and divert myself from, you know, I think a filmmaker can be their own worst enemy, right? So I didn't want to tinker. I had to preserve the energy and I didn't even read the script for a full year. I just said, I know this thing, I love this thing, and to hold on to that, let me keep it fresh. So I would come on set, I would be researched, I know the scenes that we were doing, and I'd dig in, and I know the architecture, I'd give them guidance, all the actors, but I never read it start to finish since I sort of finished the production draft in 2020.
Wow. Yeah. As audience members, I think we've been trained by action movies to think that the Terry character is going to go ballistic on these cops at the end of the movie and start killing people left and right. And he takes the non-lethal approach instead. I was wondering if you could talk about why that decision was important for you.
I do most of my decision-making based on pragmatism, plausibility, and sort of the narrative needs I need as a filmmaker. Like, how do I engineer this to work? And without going too in depth with the finale, it was new for me to not just murder everyone in my movie. using violence, you know, giving people a legitimate sort of cinematic payoff and a set piece that can resonate with them, but trying something new for me and keeping it in character. I think Terry is too much of a sort of pragmatist. He is a gentleman. Now, he certainly reaches a boiling point and explodes. There's always that sort of like inner truth for him. And it unfolded as it had to. And I embraced it and used it as a whole, like, you know, subversion of what you might expect. And especially from me.
Yeah, definitely. I do want to ask you one more thing about the ending of the movie, and I'm going to put this behind a spoiler warning, so hopefully people have seen the movie at this point. I have to admit that I was surprised by the way that the movie, which spends a huge chunk of its narrative sort of talking about the corrupt nature of the police, has several officers ride in to help sort of save the day at the end. And I was wondering if that was always something that you envisioned for the ending of the story. Was that a Netflix note? How did that come about?
No, I mean, it just... how I engineered, you know, the ending. And also, you know, on a second or third watch, I think it's very clear that the people who are part of these corrupt systems are led by a few and often don't fully believe in the system that they are sort of, you know, perpetuating. And they can find ways to disavow their own role. They can find ways to make sense. You know, I'm bringing food, put it on the table to the family, whatever they do to convince themselves. But it, you know, if you look across the battlefield in their finale, there's a lot of just humans there and they're confused. And sometimes people are pushed too far. And, you know, I just tried to infuse a level of plausibility and reality, but it's a lot to ask, you know, in a film these days where a cop can be portrayed as a human who has a limit and wants to uphold the law.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about this sort of pragmatist approach, but there's also this really wonderful feeling that I'm having trouble articulating, but especially like as the characters go down into the catacombs, I got the sense as a viewer, I'm like, of almost watching something novelistic, if that makes sense. Like it just felt like this classic story that's always existed. And I don't know if that is something that you're going for as a writer, or if you know what I'm even talking about when I mention that, where there's this sort of, it almost feels literary in a way. So can you just talk me through if that was a purposeful choice, if that kind of cerebral nonsense is even something you're thinking about when you're writing a movie, or what do you think?
I don't think about it. I just try to stay true, but I'll take that though. I'll take that. There is a lot of dialogue, you know, and I wanted to complement that dialogue with sort of set pieces. And so that catacomb sequence is very visual, sort of flashlight lit exploration. And of course there's themes. I mean, the basement there of the courthouse, that's the old Confederate courthouse and the history there. And as we scouted locations, that's something I became familiar with, is these old courthouses and the history there. And it is, it gives you pause, you know, and there's a certain amount of reverence in those. That's actually probably the most, as far as an actual theme that resonates, we touch on that. And that was sensitive to everyone involved on set. But as far as like the literary nature of it all, I definitely had fun with dialogue, and I used it to not just like hear my words spoken on set. I fucking hate dialogue. So I was surprised, but it was natural to the environment. I mean, Terry is a fish out of water. He is struggling. He is trying to abide by the rules, stay on the rails, and find out what the fuck is happening to him. And he has to interface verbally. And so all these dialogue scenes, I think, are warranted. But I wanted to supercharge the dialogue. So in some scenes, I mean, I think there's catharsis and there's these sort of exploding, you know, moments of rage and action. But the what's surprising is like how much fun I had and how much I got as a viewer out of just dialogue scenes where there's like some witty back and forths or just some tension that's mounting, and to deprive the audience of information and have them sort of be witness to this pressure cooker. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's wonderful. One thing that I've heard filmmakers say is that they quote unquote find the movie while editing it. And as they're putting it together, the movie kind of tells them what shape it wants to take and what it wants to be. And this is your first time being credited as an editor on a movie. So I was wondering what you learned about the movie during the editing process that maybe you didn't even anticipate in earlier stages of making it.
Oh, that's certainly fun. I, as the writer, director, editor, I mean, I certainly had a plan. And this is a bigger footprint for me as far as the production, the size, the cameras. We had lots of cameras rolling and wanted to get it right. But I, as an editor, just fell back to my original intention, that of my collaborators, my cinematographer. Like, I actually took great pains to infuse simplicity in the edit and make it seem as it was, very designed. And to ignore B and C camera if I had, you know, they're there for insurance. They're great operators. We're all doing great work. But for shot design and sequencing, there had to be a reason for every single camera move, for every choice in the edit room. And that was very important. Now, finding the alchemy is more technical for me. It's very mathematical. So again, I know intimately all the lines and the beats, and we shot it, right? So I'm not reinterpreting it or finding it, but I am allowing myself to be surprised. And in the process, you know, you got to pick the second best take that goes with this take, and all of a sudden the alchemy is that's the best version. But having that after so much tumult of production, I mean, when you're out there in Louisiana and it's 128 degrees with the heat index, and you know, you're sitting there with gorgeous raking sunlight, but you can't shoot because 5 miles away there's a lightning storm. Like, it's unnerving. Like, but you're facing the elements, you have no control. In the edit room, you do have control. And I found joy there. I found, as a filmmaker, when you find things that work or you create something that didn't fully exist on set, and you're giving your actors the best possible platform, and you're protecting your crew and yourself by only using, you know, the very best. It could be take two or take 12, but I would sometimes be alone above my garage editing with my Avid system and just, you know, vocally just hooting and hollering joy about finding these moments. Like, you know, when Don Johnson just nails that line, it is just, it is the best part of the process now for me.
That's awesome. How influential was First Blood on Rebel Ridge? Was that a specific inspiration for you when writing this?
So it became one. Most of my inspirations I deny initially because I wanted this to be its own thing. But once I realized by setting up the premise that it was going to be a guy against a small town police force, of course it's First Blood. I almost added a Colonel Troutman joke into one scene, actually. Because it's not a pet peeve of mine, but when films are overly sort of referential or self-referential, it kind of bugs me. I like films to be real stories I can get enthralled with and just take it on a journey. So I was disciplined about that. And was more, First Blood became more of a craft level inspiration. I mean, just the sequences, just when Stallone gets on that motorbike and just goes up into, you know, the Northwest mountains, and just the dirt, the smoke from the exhaust, the anamorphic cinematography, that was certainly a huge influence, as were many other movies. You know, I also was looking at Michael Clayton and some other sort of films that had a tactile, grounded craft to them. I think the ending of Thunderheart came to mind, which, you know, Deakins shot that years and years ago, but there's this amazing sequence where a bunch of like FBI Plymouth K cars are just driving full speed across a dirt tundra and kicking up dust. And like, I miss that. It's not, you don't feel the artificiality and the green screens. You feel just like this simplicity. I mentioned Beverly Hills Cop. The opening of that movie is a big fucking truck smashing stuff. And I get more excitement out of that because I know it's real. It's happening. It's amazing. You feel the impact than a lot of just sort of contrived stuff that's, you know, not sort of in my wheelhouse. So I want to embrace those older films texturally mostly.
Absolutely. All right. So I have one more minute with you. I just wonder, when you think back on your experience of making this movie, what's the thing that you're most proud of?
Oh, just fortitude, just sticking with it. Me finding Aaron Pierre for all these twists and turns is, I think, a career defining moment in both of our journeys. And I love him like a brother. I'm so proud of him. I said this many times and it's true. Like he's my first movie hero role. Like I don't write competent protagonists. And he was that. He was a hero on screen and off. Like he kind of saved the day for me and he overachieved. And I cannot wait to see this guy fly. He's going to be, I think he's the next big thing. And I had a small part in just, you know, sort of witnessing that journey. So
I hope to see you guys work again together soon one day. That would be awesome.
Oh, we will.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the time today, Jeremy. I appreciate it.
Likewise.
All right. I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find Chris's review of Rebel Ridge in the show notes and at slashfilm.com. You can find some other stuff about the movie there. I think I wrote up the trailer and you can find more information about John Boyega leaving the movie if you're interested in sort of digging back into the archives and finding everything else out about the movie that you can. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeBest Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly.